If you got your Bibles, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 18 today. And so if you want to find that, it'll also be up on the screen here in a minute. But Matthew chapter 18, we're going to take a look at a passage that kind of follows what I mentioned a minute ago with our children, about where he's talking about, answers the question, who is the greatest, but it kind of flows into that. And we'll kind of hit on that in a minute, but we're going to start actually in verse number 21 of Matthew 18. Verse number 21 is where we're going to be. And it says, "Then Peter came up and said to him, 'Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times?' Jesus said to him, 'I do not say to you seven times, but 70 times seven. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payments to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything." And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, "Pay what you owe." So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you." He refused and went and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. Then his master summoned him and said to him, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. If I was going to title a sermon, which I don't tend to do, and Todd's a lot better at it, and even after I preach, he comes up with a better title than I ever could have thought of when he posted on the podcast. If I was going to title this sermon, and just go with me, is Taylor Swift Got It Wrong. Okay? Stay with me, Taylor Swift fans. I'm not bashing her, okay? Some of you are like, okay, I don't even know who Taylor Swift is. Is it that blonde girl who used to sing country? Yes, that's who it was, okay? Anyway, but Taylor Swift has a new song out that is very un-Taylor Swifty, okay? She tends to be more bubbly, happy, and good things are going, and she has this song now called "Look What You Made Me Do." Okay, and the first time I listened to it, I was like, man, she's angry. Something's wrong here. Something's going on, and we could go through the whole, you know, entertainment television and all the tabloids and all the things that might be going on in Taylor's life and all those kinds of things for her to write the song and all the imagery she might throw into this song. But the main lyric that comes down to is, "Look what you made me do." And not to, like, cause any confrontation with Taylor, not that she'll ever meet me in my entire life, okay? But I feel like she got it wrong. Now, it is a song, okay? And we sometimes sing things and we come up with things as artists that oftentimes are not necessarily a moral compass or a perfect right and wrong thing, but rather it speaks about how we feel. But she writes in her song and she sings it, "Look what you made me do." And if you really think about that, there's something kind of wrong with that. And we'll kind of come back to that in a minute. But I want to take a look at this passage here at what Matthew is trying to tell in telling this story, following some of the things that just happened. We can take this passage and just kind of pull it out of its context and just talk about it just as it is, and we can laugh about the joke that's in the comic book on the bulletin, you know, not only do you want me to forgive people, but you want me to do math too, and all that kind of stuff. But the truth is that if we don't understand what's going on and what's leading up to this, we miss out on the main point that is going on and what Jesus is trying to say and what Matthew's trying to tell through telling the story about Jesus and Peter's question. So as I mentioned with our children earlier, in the beginning of chapter 18, Jesus is asked the question, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus then answers that by sitting down with a bunch of children. And he talks about any of you who would take advantage of these is no part of the kingdom. But any of you who thinks of these and takes care of these are showing what the kingdom looks like. And it really flipped things on its edge. Now, in our day, like, that's not that big of an extreme. It really isn't. If we really are to think about it, most of us are like, well, of course he cares about kids, okay? If you ask a politician, of course they're going to say they care about kids, even if their policies don't actually show that, okay? They're going to say that, and we hear that, and we think that's the norm. But in that day, children were oftentimes thought of as commodities. And I know some of y'all are like, wait, what? But the truth is that's kind of how it was, is in that day, children were often thought of as just something that passed on the bloodline and worked in the fields, and they were a commodity to just kind of have that. And yes, even in those days, they would have been sold into servanthood. And for us, that kind of just wrenches at our heart, and it should. So the very fact that Jesus sits down and says that these children are valuable rocked the very mood of what was going on in that day. It totally changed the whole idea of what we look at people, even children, and what Jesus viewed as important. And so if we take that and then take into account what happens next when he talks about how you tempt others into sin and how you should be looking at those that are in need and how even God goes after the one lost sheep, and we could read through all of chapter 18 until we get to this point where he's talking about if your brother sins against you, do this, and he gives all these things. And then Peter asks this question. And I told our students this morning in Sunday school, Peter is often the guy that we vilify or we say, man, that guy just has, like, he just says, always has the wrong thing to say. I think Peter is like the dude that just swings the pendulum from one side to the other. The story we had this morning was when Jesus washed the disciples' feet, and Peter's like, no, I should be washing your feet. And Jesus says, no, if you don't let me wash your feet, you have no place with me. And then he's like, okay, then just clean everything, my head, my whole body, and all this kind of stuff. He goes from one pendulum side to the other, swings it all the way across. And Peter oftentimes just says those things, just, bleh. You know, the word vomits? You ever had one of those moments where you just say something, you're like, oh, should take that back, right? Okay? And Peter does that, but oftentimes, too, Peter says the very thing that most of us are thinking. He really does. So in this moment where he's talking about someone who has sinned against you or, and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to go to them, I mean, Peter's like, well, how many times am I supposed to do this, Jesus? Like, at what point do I get worn out and realize that they're not ever going to change? When do I stop? And Jesus gives him a math problem, 70 times 7, okay? And it's not about how he answers, but what Jesus is doing when he answers. It's not really the answer that Jesus gives, but the underlying perspective that Peter has. You see, for Peter, N.T. Wright writes, he says, excuse me, if you're still counting how many times you've forgiven someone, you're not really forgiving them at all, but simply postponing revenge. I mean, think about that. The very idea that we're keeping score, we're thinking about what someone has done against us, and, well, man, if they do it again, what am I going to do? And, I mean, that's really how our culture looks at it. It's how governments handle things. That's how communities and businesses and things like that is like, if you wrong me, well, I'm going to get you back and then some. And we tend to run our world that way rather than through forgiveness and reconciliation. And the very underlying question that Peter has here is like, okay, but how far do I really need to go, Jesus? And Jesus reveals the very problem with what Peter says is not that he asked the question, but why he asked the question. Peter's perspective was all wrong about what it was to go and try and make things right with his neighbor. His mentality was what was being done to him rather than what he should be doing. Let's take a look at that a little bit more. He tells this parable, and, you know, oftentimes with parables, we think through multiple meanings, and oftentimes we find multiple meanings. We can read all the different parables. You got the parable of the sower, mustard seed, all these different ones. And we come to this little story that Jesus tells, and oftentimes Jesus uses extremes to kind of make a point and all the different things that are going on there. And he tells this story about a king or a ruler that has these servants, and the servant owes him money. Basically, what it would have probably meant is this servant was supposed to do a certain amount of work and get a certain amount of money and then bring it to the king, and he hadn't been doing that, and it equaled a lot of money. And if you were to think about how much that was, it would have been way beyond anything anybody in this room really could probably even muster financially. It was a lot. So somewhere along the way, maybe this guy was embezzling. We don't really know, and really that's not the point of the story. We just know that the amount that was owed was astronomical and beyond anything that this man could ever even come close to. And he begs the man, or begs the king for mercy, and the king shows him mercy. Okay? And then he turns around and he does what? He goes to another servant who owes him money, not near the amount that he owes, and he hammers down the law and ends up throwing the guy in prison and doesn't reciprocate the very thing that had been shown to him. The forgiveness and the mercy that was shown to him, he just turns around and doesn't show to this other man. You know, thinking about N.T. Wright's quote, it's just postponing revenge. We think of revenge, I mean, I don't know if you're like me, when you hear the word revenge, you think like, well, that's harsh. Like, I don't ever really, when I'm having a hard time forgiving somebody, I'm not thinking revenge on anybody. I don't have any like vengeful thoughts. I want, you know, them to go through bad things or anything like that. But I can't let that go, or I don't want to have anything to do with them, or those kinds of things. And I started to look up the definition of revenge, and most definitions are very blunt, and it talks about like a very negative, like I want what's worst for this person and revenge and all those kinds of things. And I started doing some reading, and another guy came up and he kind of talked about, you know, oftentimes we go to the far extreme of revenge, but oftentimes revenge is just wanting someone to get theirs, whatever it might be. And so what that means is when we think of someone wronging me and my need to forgive, we oftentimes want them to just get some type of justice, right? We want them to get that. You know, in my personal life of things going on and whatnot, there's been different times where I know I've messed up and probably not done what Jesus mentions to Peter and the other disciples right before this, where I've gone to that person and said, hey, I've messed up here and I need to make things right, or I've just tried to avoid it and move on and those kinds of things, and I know those people have still forgiven me. And then there's been times in my life where somebody has maybe done something that has affected me or had a negative impact on me, and forgiveness is hard. I mean, can we all agree? It's not like, it doesn't seem like the easiest thing to do. Forgiveness is hard. Because most of the time with forgiveness, it's that forgetting part. You know, an elephant never forgets. And neither do people who've been hurt. I mean, it's hard to move past the very idea that someone did this to me. How do I react? I think therein lies the main question of where our perspective is. Oftentimes is a lot like Taylor Swift's song, "Look What You Made Me Do." This person did this to me, so look what they made me do in my reaction. And the truth is, no one ever makes us do anything. We choose our reactions, we choose our responses, and we make the decision on how we're going to react to a situation that comes to us. Well, yes, somebody may inflict something that causes emotional pain and difficultness and all that. Difficultness? That's not even a word. Difficulty. Those kinds of things upon us, but how we respond and what we do from there has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with us. I can sit here and say, you know, you made me mad. No, you did something that I choose to be mad about. And the perspective is different. You know, I tell our youth this story, and this story, I don't know why, it always comes to mind when I think of forgiveness. A while back, there was, in an Amish community, there was a shooting. A man showed up in this Amish community, no no reason or anything like that, just showed up in this community and started shooting up. Killed several people and then ended up killing himself. And in the midst of all this, all of the heartbreak that this community had undergone and all the things that had gone on with that was the wife of the man who had done the shooting. And many would have thought that this community, the last thing on their minds would have been trying to comfort the wife of the man who had killed all of the people in this community. Rather, they would be more focused on taking care of the people in their community and what was going on there, and making sure everybody's okay, or maybe even having some type of justice, revenge thoughts. And instead, the people of this community found the wife, okay, went and found the wife of this man and let her know that they were there for her and that they had forgiven a long time ago, before it even happened, had chosen to forgive this man for anything that had been done against them, and they wanted to know how they could help her. Whew. I mean, if you were to put that into a movie or a, you know, News 9 story, I mean, there'd probably be not many dry eyes in the room. But the difference is that community had made the decision before anything had ever happened that they were going to be a community who showed mercy and sought peace. They had made the decision before, way before anything had ever happened, that they were going to be peaceful, merciful people. And so that's what they did. It was who they are. They chose to do that. And I think that's really the underlying thing in the question that Peter asks is not what's going wrong or not how many times I need to forgive, but really Peter's perspective on what type of person he needed to be. That's really what the root of the question is. And that's how Jesus answers is what type of person are you going to be? Because the kingdom of God looks like this, but yet you're counting. This is the type of person that you need to be. Another one of our passages for this morning comes from Genesis chapter 50, which is the very end of the book of Genesis, and it's the story of Joseph being met again with his brothers. And if you don't remember the story of Joseph, Joseph is the last one in the line of the four major patriarchs of the Hebrew people. You have Abraham, who then has Isaac, who then has Jacob and Esau, and Jacob steals the birthright from Esau, and there's this whole big old shebang of mess up there. Jacob then eventually has a son named Joseph amongst all of his other sons, and he loves Joseph for a lot of different reasons. We won't get into all of that, but for some reason, Joseph became his favorite, and he gave him a coat of many colors, and his brothers didn't like it, okay? His brothers were very angry. They were like, no, why is this younger pipsqueak the guy that's going to get all of the love of dad? And they didn't like it. And not to get into the fact that Jacob maybe was probably wrong in how he showed love to his kids and how he showed favoritism, Joseph really had done nothing wrong other than he was at the blunt end of what was going on. So his brothers, being jealous and angry, ended up selling him into slavery. And Joseph, being in slavery, ends up moving his way out of the Canaan area and moves into Egypt. He's taken and sold into Egypt. He eventually is then working his way up into Potiphar's house, and he's doing a lot of things. And Potiphar was a wealthy man, had a man of a lot of influence, and his wife tries to take advantage of Joseph. Joseph doesn't do anything, but then she tells a lie. Potiphar's obviously going to believe his wife over Joseph, throws Joseph in jail. Joseph then now is locked away, sold into slavery from his own family, and then lied to, put into prison in Egypt, far away from his home, from anybody he knows, feels all alone, and he's in the middle of this prison. And then certain circumstances come about to a certain point that then Joseph has this opportunity to start explaining dreams, and people then are coming to Joseph, having him explain their dreams. And while he's doing that, Pharaoh finds out about it, and he brings in, and Joseph finds out about Pharaoh's dreams and tells him about it and all these different things. And Joseph, somehow, in the midst of all of the negative, becomes like second in charge over all of Egypt. And to be a Hebrew man, second in charge over all of Egypt, is a big, big deal. But Pharaoh trusted him, and he had worked his way up, and all of the negative and all the things that had happened to him then culminated into this moment where there was a famine, and Egypt had been prepared because Joseph had foretold the dream. They had been putting away food and all these things like that, but in Cana, they hadn't. And here comes this group of people who Joseph recognizes as his family, his brothers, who had sold him into slavery, and he finds this moment where he's faced with the very choice of, what do I do now? What will my reaction be? And to make the whole long story short, the brothers recognize then who it is that it's their brother. They get very nervous because they know what they did. And Joseph then offers them forgiveness. And he welcomes them in, gives them something to eat, and takes care of them. After all he'd been through, after everything that had gone on. And we can look at this, and part of the story mentions that the brothers told him what their father would wanted, and that's for him to forgive. But I really look at it, and the very idea of Joseph forgiving was that's the type of person Joseph was. That was the type of person that Joseph chose to be. I mean, you don't go through all of the things that he went through and somehow still find a positive in the midst of all the negative. He had chose to live his life a certain way and to make a decision that he was going to be this type of person. That's why when his brothers come to him, instead of anger and hatred and resentment, he sees compassion and mercy. That was his choice. That was the type of person that he was to be. And I think that's the deep root of the question that we have here when Jesus is asked the question by Peter. And Jesus answers the question with a story and a math problem. But really, what Jesus answers it by telling Peter, what type of person are you going to choose to be? What kind of perspective are you going to have on the world around you and how you interact with people? Because while you may not be able to control what happens to you, you do get to control your response to the situations in your life. And as followers of Jesus who have recognized the great, amazing forgiveness, just like the servant in the story has experienced through his king, that it is an astronomical debt that he owes, that there is absolutely no way he would ever be able to repay it, is the same way in our relationship with God, knowing that we have an astronomical debt that we can never pay on our own, and we've been shown forgiveness, and therefore, how do then we respond to the world around us who needs to be shown forgiveness and mercy? I want to read another quote. This is again from N.T. Wright. And he says, the key thing, as I have already said, is not that one should therefore swallow all resentment and forgive and forget as though nothing had happened. The key thing is that one should never, ever give up making forgiveness and reconciliation one's goal. If confrontation has to happen, as it often does, it must always be with forgiveness in mind, never revenge. The choice we then get to make, and we've been called to make, in all life situations, good, bad, and in between, is, are we going to seek the route of peace and reconciliation, or are we going to choose to be angry and resentful? And really what it comes down to is it's not when something happens, but the decision that we make before anything happens in our lives, that that's the type of people we're going to be. That we will choose forgiveness over revenge. We will choose reconciliation over retaliation. It's the peaceful way that we've been called to live, and that's what Jesus is trying to get across to Peter by giving him a ridiculous math problem and over-the-top story, is that the problem is not how many times, but the very idea that you're even asking the question. Because the type of person we're supposed to be as followers of Jesus is this, and he gives the example of what that looks like.